This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me for another exciting episode of New Books Network's African American Studies podcast. I am your host, Katrina Anderson. Today, I am joined by Victoria Perry, who has a PhD and is a historian and an architect and director at Donald Insdell Associates, Architects and Historic Building Consultants. She's an examiner at the Bartlett School of Architecture, the University College of London. She has contributed to the Oxford Companion to Black British History and English Heritage's Slavery and the British Country House. Today, we're going to be discussing her magnificent book, A Bittersweet Heritage, Slavery, Architecture, and the British Landscape. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Perry.
Hello.
So, can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes, well, the book was based on my PhD done at the Bartlett School of Architecture, and I completed it back in 2009. And its subtitle is Slavery, Architecture and the British Landscape. And it was really an investigation of how wealth from 18th century sugar plantations in what were then the British island colonies in the Caribbean not only funded country houses and landscapes, but also were invested into road construction, particularly in the west of Britain. And this had really quite a transformative effect, turning areas that had previously been quite poor and remote, some of them, into celebrated tourist sites. The Wye Valley, Snowdonia, the lakes in the Scottish Highlands. I don't know if USA listeners will have heard of those areas, but they're quite well known in Britain now.
Now, how did you become interested in this topic and what made you write about it? You mentioned your PhD, so I guess we should start there.
Well, it was before my PhD. When I was a student architect, I was working in conservation. It was one summer holiday on the restoration of a shell grotto. It was a folly grotto. It was in the grounds of a country house that was an ornamental folly, really designed to pique the senses and something, think about something very beautiful and quite frivolous. And I was enjoying working on it. In my summer holidays, we camped in the walled vegetable garden, or what had been a vegetable garden of this country house. And it was a fun summer job. And then the director of the project said he was going to the Caribbean to get shells to match those in the grotto. And I suddenly thought, oh, that's really strange. 18th century Caribbean and this grotto. You know, I knew a little bit about the slave trade then, but very little else. And I couldn't really make that connection between the two things I was seeing. And it was only really about 10 years later, I didn't really have any chance to do anything about it. But 10 years later, I was actually on maternity leave. And I had moved from the countryside on the Welsh borders where I grew up. And I was living in East London in Hackney, which is an area with a big Afro-Caribbean population. And my children went to local nurses. So I was sort of picking up a little bit about what was called Black history then. I just happened to read a book about my the area. It was a guide to architecture about the area where I grew up on the Welsh borders, and it talked about a place called Piercefield Park, which was quite close to where I grew up, and it had been built really on the proceeds of money that had been and come from plantations in the Caribbean. And I was just really sort of the link between this landscapes really of my own childhood, which became quite famous, and Caribbean slavery. I thought, oh, this is quite an extraordinary link. I need to do something about it. So after a couple of months doing some background research and talking to people, I eventually got a little bit of funding and decided to embark on a part-time PhD. That's a long answer to that question, I think.
But a great one, because it shows like where this all started and how that was something that remained with you as you were going throughout the process. So as you were starting to do this, what type of sources did you use as you were writing the book?
Well, for me, because I trained as an architect, as well as having a training in history, so obviously I had key primary sources, which were building and estate archives, and they were held in the local record offices around the country. And an archivist actually helped me find those. And I selected seven different archives to look at in detail originally. But for me, as an architect, I find that buildings and landscapes and elements of material culture like maps and paintings were very important. So I have a mixture of sources, obviously, as well as a lot of secondary background reading.
Now, how challenging was the research process for you as you were doing all of this?
It was. I started research, I mean, it's 20 years ago now. Obviously, the internet, I feel very ancient when I say this, though. The internet was really in its infancy for research use. So I did a lot of travel around the country. And also just trying to pick up the background history was quite difficult for me. Sort of coming really from an art and architectural background. So, but fortunately for me, where I lived in Hackney, there was a very good sort of quotes called Black History section in the local library. So I sat in there really devouring basic texts and trying to understand, those links and thinking, really, something I hadn't been taught at school at all.
Wow, I can just, I can see like those moments of like, it's just like, wow, the connections that you can draw from just having a physical structure and not knowing like what its connections were to slavery and the slave trade during that period.
Yeah.
Now, as you were researching, was there anything in particular that kind of like you were just like, wow, as you were researching?
For me, I suppose it was the sheer economic and cultural importance of the Caribbean islands to 18th century and early 19th century Britain. I just hadn't realized how important they were and the links between Jamaica and Barbados and those historical links. And for me, the idea that where I grew up, there was a place called Barbados Woods. And I thought, oh, okay, I get the connections now. I understand why, what's going on and its importance of sugar to the British cuisine, and the British seem to be very, very keen on sugar of all the European nations. They were ones that used sugar, and there was this huge demand for sugar that was grown on the plantations by enslaved labor. So that was a big shock, really.
Well, it's interesting because, and this is how we're going to kind of dive into the book, you actually got a chance to visit the Caribbean islands and to see some of the 18th century buildings and landscapes that were there. Can you talk a little bit about that, what that was like?
Yeah, I mean, I felt for me that it was very important that I was looking at buildings and landscapes for the elite in Britain, so that I actually needed to understand the sources of the wealth, and I needed to look at these buildings in the same way as I was looking at the elite buildings in Britain. So I was very fortunate to get some funding and go to the Caribbean and West Africa. So I'd been to Eastern North Africa previously, so sort of in Africa that wasn't so that wasn't so much of a shock of what I saw. But I have to say, I was very nervous visiting the Caribbean. I was with a group of academics rather than going on my own. But most people in Britain, or most white British people, viewed the Caribbean, then certainly, viewed the islands as sort of luxury winter holiday destinations. And I knew too much. So when I went, but I was very aware of what I was looking at. I was seeing with my eyes, you know, as a white woman. And I remember there was an Afro-Caribbean colleague there, and she was quite angry. And I felt empathy, but maybe not anger, but perhaps I'd feel anger now. Now I know even more. But it was, I think, very important to actually see these spaces for myself and be there.
Now, as you were looking at, you know, the structures and everything, and on the different islands, are they similar? Did you find them similar to each other? Were they different? Or were there this kind of uniformity that developed in the Caribbean?
I have to say that I wasn't able to go to that many islands. I was just visited the islands in the Leeward, so I didn't get to see. I would have loved to have gone to Jamaica and Cuba and travelled around a lot. So I can't really comment to say how similar they are. But I think it was just very important to see a boiling house, and actually where the sugar cane was grown, and how it was not refined, but how it was sort of first produced. And actually, when I went, and it was quite some time ago now, it was the last commercial crop was being grown of sugar cane. And I just remember one of our guides, he took us to a cane field and chopped a piece of cane down and gave us a little piece. And it was just such a significant moment for me, because I realized that this guy's ancestors, if his ancestors had chopped and taken a piece of cane like that, they would have had most terrible, terrible punishments. And what he was doing was very significant moment that marked it all out. It was, yeah, and I think actually going to the Caribbean and seeing that gave me an understanding that I wouldn't have necessarily got if I just looked at paper archives.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when we think about sugar, and, you know, it's really, especially during slavery, it was such a labor intensive process. Yes. That everything that went into it, it took so much time, and that work was harsh and demanding. But, you know, as you said, it was a staple, and it was high in demand. So there was a lot of it produced, especially on the Caribbean islands during this period. And, you know, just, you know, for, as you say, the guide to go and to get a piece of that, that meant a lot, because during that time, the punishment for doing something like that was pretty steep.
Yeah.
For the enslaved workers.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a lot. So that was, I'm glad you got a chance to go down and were able to see that. So as you were down there, of course, there's John Boyd and Danson House. What can you tell us, you know, as you're reflecting, as you're coming back, what can you tell us about John Boyd and Danson House in Southeast London, with all of this in mind, about how everything that's going on in the Caribbean, and then, you know, you're coming back across the Atlantic and you're looking at this magnificent structure. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that was, I think, just the flight looking over the sea was actually quite amazing, and thinking actually now the sea, the Atlantic is sort of a barrier, but actually then it was a means of communication, because obviously everything came by ship then. And the Boyd's house, so Boyd was a plantation heir who actually had a plantation on Nevis, I think it was, which I visited. And he moves to London when he's probably in his early teenager with his parents, in the 1740s, and his father, who is becomes an absentee owner, he becomes a merchant in the city of London, which is obviously dealing with all of Europe, a merchant trade with Europe at the time, but becomes a sugar merchant. And they become very profitable, the sugar merchants. But his father decides to invest in a consortium which basically buys an island, a slave training island called Banse Island or Bunce Island off the coast of what is now Sierra Leone. And he makes a huge fortune through slave trading and trading and other things as well, and ends up building this extraordinary house called Danson Park, which is not so far from the River Thames and the City of London.
Oh wow, that just seems truly, you know, as I'm conceptualizing this and thinking about it, you know, what that actually meant and that structure and how it's created. So with John Boyd, he's coming back and he's setting up this magnificent house. So how did architecture aid the Boyd family in becoming English gentlemen during this time? Because, you know, he's involved in this industry that some may look frown upon, I would want to say. How does that help him to assume that gentlemanly manner during the 18th century?
Yeah. Well, I think during the 18th century, if you wanted social status in Britain, you needed to be a landowner. So Boyd spends his money buying land, and he builds a wonderfully beautiful new neoclassical house by one of the most fashionable architects of the day. And he then creates a landscape around this house, which is a sort of vast 70 acre. Do you have acres in USA or hectares? I don't know.
We do. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
They're acres, 70 acres. So it's an ornamental lawn called a park around it. And so this is quite a fashionable thing to do at the time among sort of major landowners. But Boyd does it. And so you can't really tell if he's an established British landowner or not. So his wealth is quite new, but he's sitting himself within a broader society and actually becoming a gentleman. He's not just a merchant. He's someone who has land and does the right sort of thing. I don't know explains that word.
But, you know, that's so fascinating. Just the thought that, you know, he's procuring as much land as possible, setting it up very nicely, and it's so well done that leads him to becoming a gentleman during this period.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that most of his land that in Britain is primarily ornamental. They have a small home farm, but actually he's making his money primarily from land in the Caribbean. You know, it's extraordinarily the sugar was so valuable compared with crops that could have been grown in Britain, like barley or wheat. So all of his agricultural wealth was from the Caribbean.
Wow. That's amazing. And what I found that I was just like, as I was reading, it's like, there is no mention of how Boyd got his wealth. You know, as you're visiting the site, there's no mention whatsoever of what he was involved in and how this ties back to slavery and the slave trade. Can you talk about that? That was just fascinating to me.
Yeah, I think things maybe have changed now. I haven't been back to the house for some time. And I think people, certainly since the Black Lives Matter protests in Britain, are a little bit more aware of these things. But that it wasn't really explained when I went round at all to look at the house. So things are changing a little bit now. But when you start looking at the house, funnily, even in the architecture, you've got things like mahogany doors, And now, in an 18th century house, mahogany is a tropical hardwood. And in the mid 18th century, most of that, it was very, very expensive, but most of it would have come from the Caribbean and Jamaica. And so to actually have that in your house, people have been able to really read it and actually understand, oh, actually, that you have Caribbean wealth. And in the mid-18th century in Britain, people wouldn't have necessarily seen that as bad. It was only in the later 18th century when actually people in Britain realised exactly what was going on in terms of on the plantations, that and there began to be protests and thoughts of anti-slavery movement got going, that would have been sort of less reputable. But in the mid 18th century, having mahogany and showing that you were a sugar merchant or a sugar owner was fine.
Oh, wow. That is just so mind-boggling. But, and I was talking with this with another scholar about it the other day, thinking about, yes, you're involved in slavery and the slave trade, but you have to take yourself out of the mindset of 2023 where you see that as how could you possibly do something like this. It's more of this is a business enterprise. This is how I make money. It's not, it's just they were commodities that were bought and sold on that level. It's not, it's how I earn a living,
Yeah.
Sadly, that's what it boiled down to. But, to take the human aspect out of it, that's just, it's so hard, it's so hard to do, I think, now, just in one's mindset. It's just very, very hard to do. But the Boyd House was not the only home that you actually visited, which is, you have like this completely different side, and it's the Lancelos family and Harewood House. How was that a different experience that you had? How was it similar and how was it different there?
It was, the Searles family, they were already quite wealthy and very established landowners in Yorkshire, which was a wealthy county for several centuries. And the Searles were a wealthy family, but they really augmented their wealth by investing into the Caribbean. So you've got an even bigger house than Danson, Harewood House. It was called a palace at the time. Now, I think most British people hadn't seen anything quite as grand as this, except for sort of royal palaces. So it was extraordinary statement of wealth.
Wow, that is just like to think about that and conceptualize what that meant during this time period. Now, you mentioned that in the book that the Harewood House makes notes of its ties to slavery. They're upfront about what happened and how the wealth was made. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still privately owned, Harewood House, which is very interesting. I think Lord Harewood lives in the grounds rather than the main house, which is you can visit it as a visitor. But they've been incredibly open about their links with slavery and have talked about it. And yeah, I think it's been really a really good thing that he's been quite brave. I think there's a lot of quite wealthy established families who do have these links, who've not necessarily talked about it in the same way and been so open. And I think Lord Harewood is really to be commended for having the bravery to do this.
I agree with that assessment that he's upfront and he discusses it. And as you say, you can tour the grounds to actually see what was built. So that just seems like really, really a cool thing to be able to do. Now, there's another very, very famous place, Bath, which, I've read about it so many places in history books as I've been researching of my own and, like across the Atlantic here, there are certain communities that want to set up something as fashionable as Bath. How did bath gain its status during this period?
Well, say Bath was this, you know, very famous sort of fashionable spa resort, and I think we know of it today because of Jane Austen talks about it, and it's a World Heritage Site, and it's a very beautiful city. The centre, it's lovely, beautiful golden stone houses that terraced houses that sort of tip down to the centre, and my grandparents used to live there, so I know that. Know the town very well, and I remember there was some sort of celebration actually when I was a child, and everyone had to sort of dress in 18th century outfits with sort of parasols and parade around, and I think, you know, it was all very pretty and lovely. But then during my research, I started realizing that there was something more about Bath, and then it actually clicked that Bath is actually quite close to Bristol, which in the time that Bath was being developed was Britain's second most important Atlantic port, and Bristol's background is plantation produce and slave trading with the tobacco plantations on what is now mainland USA and the Caribbean, and Bath was really where money from the plantations mixed with moneyed people from the rest of Britain. So it was a big place to, if you wanted to introduce your daughter to an eligible bachelor, you would do so in Bath. So this is very much a place where, say, money from the plantation colonies comes into British society. I call it the capital of the Atlantic West in my book, because it looks west to the colonies.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's as I'm thinking here about Bath, and you're right mentioning Jane Austen, because I've read a lot of her novels, and Bath, you always have this image in your mind of what it is, because it's like this fashionable place where everyone goes there, as you say, to find a husband. That is what is the marriage mart. That's where you're going to do all of this, but it's close to Bristol, which was the slave trading port. That's just so fascinating to see those linkages that are there today with that. Now, there was someone that you mentioned in your book, Valentine Morris, and very interesting place, Peacefield Park. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, Peacefield is the place which, you say, is not so far from where I grew up, which really stimulated me to do the PhD. And Valentine Morris was a plantationaire from Antigua, and he with his family they moved to Britain. They became absentees, and his father bought land. It's just across the River Severn from Bristol, near a place called Chepstow, and they proceeded to his father died, and Valentine proceeded to spend all his wealth on landscaping his new parkland, creating parkland. This is sort of similar thing to what Boyd is doing, but he's actually doing it 20 years before Boyd. But what's important about Peacefield is that it actually becomes a big tourist destination, because it's on the side of an extraordinary cliff, and people from Bath, visitors to Bath, come and they take the ferry over from. There's a sort of commercial ferry that goes across the Severn. They go to Wales, and they visit this parkland and look at these amazing views from it. And it becomes known as the Wye Tour, and it becomes really celebrated throughout Britain. And and it was this discovery that that money from the Wye Tour. Well, from slavery had helped to fund the popularity of the Wye Tour, because it actually funded turnpike roads as well as these construction of these new views. And that was really stimulated me to think about doing a PhD. And again, there's a connection with Austin. Again, when I thought about this building, I thought, oh, of Mansfield Park, because of course in Mansfield Park, the book, the builder of Mansfield Park is also an Antiguan plantation owner. And I thought, oh, actually, there's a fictional Mansfield Park here. What story can it help tell me about my real Piercefield Park? Can I look at that? And when I started looking at it actually through that sort of lens of I've forgotten his name now, culture, it's called Culture and Imperialism, Edward Said, and he does an analysis of Jane Austen's Mansfield Park of the book, and I really, that got me thinking about, well, can I look at buildings in the same ways you can sort of analyze books, like say it does. That's a long, slightly rambling answer there, Katrina. Sorry.
No, that's actually a perfect answer, because I was thinking, as you mentioned, you know, Austin and Mansfield Park and the connection with Edward Said, and how can you use that? Because, you know, it's something typically, it's becoming more widespread. Now, initially, there was hesitancy to go outside of what they consider proper historical sources. But that's one of the things that I'm glad now that there is more room to bring in other mediums for scholars to look at.
Yeah, I was very much trying to struggle and find my way, and really, I thought at Said, you know, help me formulate my thoughts and how I was going to tackle things, because there wasn't nowadays in Britain, I'm not sure, so sure about the USA, but there's a lot of interest in sort of imperial history, and a lot of scholars looking at that. But 20 years ago, it wasn't in the same way at all.
I know. That's one of the things where it's just like, oh my gosh, because time has changed. But it's done some great technology, as you say, and this changing idea of what history is, it's much more inclusive now to bring in, you know, to do kind of the historical architecture, bringing in art and literature, which I definitely think is a positive in so many ways, because it can be used historically. And Said, he did a great job of doing that and showing scholars how to use that. And that's where I want to delve into. There were some terms that you actually mentioned, the sublime and picturesque in 18th century. How important was that in 18th century?
Yeah, I think it's for an educated elite in the 18th century, it's a way of looking at topography of the natural world and comparing it to the fashionable landscape paintings of areas that they'd seen, or maybe friends had seen, on the Grand Tour of Europe, which was that was the thing that was a popular activity for Britain's aristocrats, or certainly the sons, not necessarily the daughters. And it's really the origins, the ideas of sublime. Sublime is slightly scary, but it's an emotional response to landscape. And picturesque is a sweeter response to landscape. And they used it for landscape, but it's broader than that. It's about an emotional response. And it's really the origins of the term natural scenery that we still use today.
Which is fascinating, because that becomes connected to something else that's going on during this period and that continues to grow, landscape tourism. Can you talk about the connections to that?
Yeah, there were two things that are happening at the time, and this is what I try and unpick gently in the book, is that you have there's an increasing wealth in the ports of the west of Britain. So you've got Bristol, which is a plantation, a port primarily dealing in plantation produce. And then you go north, you go up, you get Liverpool, which is again growing in the 18th century, dealing in very similar things. Then you go further north, Lancaster and Whitehaven are ports which are slave trading ports, also dealing in sugar and tobacco. And then further north again, you get to Glasgow. And so in a way, like Boyd is near the point of Port of London, and Morris's family are not so far from the Port of Bristol, you have merchants and absentee landowners. They start settling near these ports, which are actually quite remote from what were historically in Britain the major centres of trade, which were predominantly with continental Europe. So that you start seeing this swing economically. Adam Smith, the economist, talks about it, how there's, I don't think he uses the word pivot, because I think that's a more modern word, but how it's a change of direction between British trade. And so you're seeing this new wealth that's going along the west of Britain, which is, and the west of Britain is quite different geologically from the east. It's basically much more rocky. I can't call it mountains compared with what you have in the USA, but they're steep hills. It looks very different. And so you start seeing the celebration of these areas, which had previously been quite poor and remote, and they start becoming wealthy. People start living there. They start building houses. They paint, they commission artists to do paintings. They help organize building roads. And so they start really celebrating these Western landscapes. Again, that's probably quite a long rambling answer there, Katrina.
No, it's all of the connections that are happening to that, because it's, you know, during this period, you are starting to see the tourism begin to pick up. And, you know, that's why I want to ask you about Edmund Burke and William Gilpin, they were connected to the transatlantic slave trade. Can you talk a little bit about their connections?
Yeah, I mean, Edmund Burke, he writes, he becomes later quite an important politician in Britain, but he also writes a book about the sublime and the beautiful, which becomes a very important sort of philosophical book. But he has a brother who is a plantation trader, and actually he writes a book, and I forget what it's called now. But it's about the plantation trade of the colonies. So Edmund Burke knows, really through familial connections, about what's going on. And William Gilpin, who writes, again, is one of the sort of major theoretical writers about, a populist about landscape and appreciating landscape and promoting landscape tourism in a very popular way. He writes a book called Observations on the Picturesque, which is all about the Wye Valley and really helps to increase its popularity even more. He writes about the Wye Valley. He writes about travelling in Cumbria and the Lake District and also Scotland. But he is from a family of tobacco and sugar planters and traders from the port of Whitehaven, which is on the west coast of Cumbria. It's descended from this wider family. So again, he understands about, you know, what is going on in the colonies, and he's connected. There's financial connections with the colonies and the plantation colonies.
Well, it's just, you know, it's amazing to think how deep the ties are going into slavery and the slave trade during this period, and what they're who they're connected to during this time. And, you know, just one of the many things that your book does an excellent job of is connecting the wealth of slave traders to, like, even more what we consider more remote areas, such as Cumberland and Westmoreland and even the western coast of Scotland. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's just like mind-boggling.
Well, I think, yeah, because we think of them as quite remote because they're remote. Well, I think it was remote, you know, because I live in London now, and they were remote from centres of population and London, which, say, was primarily wealth was about trading with Europe. And so it's switched over. It's now trading transatlantic. And so you're getting wealth that's going up to the northwest of Scotland, which can fund a construction of a beautiful house in this quite rugged landscape, because that's where the money is coming from. And it's not so remote if you're doing if you were sailing from the southern states of the USA or the Caribbean, it was about a 6 to 7 week voyage with the trade winds and currents going north then. And so it's actually not, there was a sort of link between the people along the west coast, so it wasn't very far if you were doing that transatlantic voyage. Then the difference between your ship might call in at Bristol and then go up further to Liverpool, or you'd have friends or family in those ports. And so there was really a start of a link of peoples across the ocean and going up this west coast.
Wow, that is just, because I know there are certain places here in the United States, that we of course think as being more remote than others. But as you say, it's not really as remote as you think about it. And I always have this picture in my mind of, you've got the English coast and then you're going kind of like into that more interior region, and you have like this, this country cottage feel to it. And just kind of like picturing what that image brings to mind. Now, things are changing by the time we get to the second half of the 18th century. You have this rise in landscape tours during this period that gains prominence. Can you talk about how that happened during this period?
Yeah, I mean, it's partly because of investment in better roads, and one of the places that is important is Snowdonia, which is sort of mountainous area of North Wales, and you're getting money here from Liverpool traders who are building houses on the coast there, but also these sort of the economic sort of infrastructure is sort of going up into the mountains. And I actually found this in a way quite recently after the end of my PhD, that the Welsh wool spinners who were living in these tiny cottages in the mountains, before cotton was really started growing, they were actually weaving something called Welsh planes, which was very simple fabric, very sort of coarse fabric, which was sent out to the colonies to clothe enslaved people. And I couldn't quite believe it when I read this. And I thought, oh my goodness, there's a link from, it's not just the bigger houses on the coast, it's a tiny little cottage. That economy went right up into the hills. And yeah, it quite shocked me, actually. That was quite a recent discovery while I was doing the update of my PhD into the book.
That actually just really shocked me, too, that there's this cottage where you're having clothes made that are going to the enslaved population.
And
that's just mind-boggling to think about.
Well, also, the idea of being in the Caribbean and wearing wool. I just can't imagine it.
That's, for us right now, this time of year, as everyone's literally freezing, you would appreciate that. But you're in this very warm environment where you're also engaged in labor-intensive work. I can imagine wearing that, and also, as you're working in the field and you're working so hard from sun up to sundown, what that could possibly do, especially in terms of just like skin irritation.
Yeah, no, so scratchy. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
Wow, that's just, you've given me a very interesting tidbit to nibble on. thinking about that.
Yeah, that's quite recent research that I just happened to, I'm not sure, even sure if that's, I think I just mentioned it very briefly in the book, but I thought, oh gosh, that is so interesting. And that's the amazing thing at the moment. There is just more and more and more research that's being done in Britain. The great thing is that something that I was just seeing really as a sort of a shadowy pattern, I think I'm thinking, oh yeah, I was right, wasn't I? You know, I it was what I thought it was. which is great to see.
Yeah, it's fascinating as you're doing this and your work, it's inspiring others now to take this up. So, you know, but things, they also change with the 18th century, because as you're going, you know, into the 19th century, people are starting to question their involvement in slavery and the slave trade. So how is that shown in landscape, or is it shown in the landscape?
Well, it's interesting that eventually in Britain, we have an act in 18, it takes a long time to happen, but in 1833, there's the Abolition of Slavery Act. This is a big, big political change in Britain, and because the people who have plantations, they're quite a powerful voice in the British Parliament, and it's a big thing to do this to, and there is state compensation for all of the slave owners, not the enslaved people, and that's what I found really, really shocking. But a massive amount of state compensation was paid to slave owners in order to abolish slavery. This compensation money was invested into buildings, roads, and actually colonial ventures in Asia, and actually railways in Britain. There's a very good database that's called the Legacy of British Slavery Project at University College London, at my university, which is really worth looking at. But for me, in terms of landscape, there is an extraordinary Roman-style stone triumphal arch. And it's not so far from Bath, and it would have been on one of the main roads to Bath, near a place called Stroud. And it was erected by a mill owner. As far as I know, he wasn't a slave owner at all. It wasn't erected with compensation money. But it really memorialises the abolition of slavery, and it's now in the middle of a social housing estate, but it would have been an extraordinarily visible monument in the landscape. And that's, I think, there are lots of statues, little small statues, but that is the main piece of landscape art, I think, celebrates abolition.
Wow, just to think about, you know, even as you do have that Slavery Abolition Act in 1833, you know, you do have this monumental piece of art in the landscape that's, you know, commemorating that. That's just fascinating, you know, and I'm sure there were some who agreed and some who did not, but it's nice to have that there where it can be seen during this period of time. So, Dr. Perry, I want to ask you, what do you want readers to take away from the book?
Ooh, I think sometimes the history of art and architecture, you know, especially sort of 18th and 19th century, can sometimes it can be seen as a little bit frivolous. But I think that you can have beautiful historic buildings, landscapes, and paintings, and they provide, you know, obviously they provide delight, but they can also tell serious stories about entwined, complex, even if they're a bit uncomfortable. And I think there's a way of, I'm quite a believer in stealth education and in actually entertaining people, but giving them more, I know you can go around a country house and enjoy it, but you can also learn something quite profound as you do that. And I think in the USA, you're perhaps ahead of us in Britain in acknowledging sort of complex histories. But it's one of the things I've been thinking about with about Piercefield, this ruined country house, that it really, really got me going as the subject of my PhD. And I gave a talk actually where I was I suggested getting a group of people to buy Piercefield. It's in the grounds of a race course and the ruins, and transform it as a centre of understanding. It's quite close to several big cities. You can get there by public transport, and it's ruined stables. Turn them into holiday cottages so people could see these extraordinary landscapes and have an amazing restaurant with, you know, the best of Afro-Caribbean cuisine. I don't know, a bit like there's a restaurant called the Grey in Savannah in Georgia, which I've sort of read quite a lot about. And I just think, oh, that'd be a wonderful thing to do, to actually use buildings and landscapes to say, to talk about these entwined histories, and to explain to all British people why the Afro-Caribbean who predominantly live in our big cities, I have to say, in Britain, rather than the countryside, but to actually explain that, you know, this countryside is yours too. You know, your families have connections with it. You should be out here walking and enjoying it, and not feeling that you're new to this country, because you're connected. And everyone else needs to know that too. And it's very much a shared history, and architecture can really help in that. I don't know if that's a very good answer.
That's an excellent answer. That is a magnificent answer that really conceptualizes your book. So Dr. Perry, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been really fantastic talking to you about it. And it's good to talk about, to rethink about what I was trying to do in the book. And how, yeah, so it's been great fun. Thank you very much for asking me all these questions.
Readers, please go out and pick up a copy of Dr. Perry's A Bittersweet Heritage. I will say this is a book that you will not regret picking up. It is highly readable. I always like to say that. It's academic, but it's also readable for the general population. It is holiday time. So you never know. Someone that you know may be interested in the history of art and architecture in England and Great Britain. I know that's a fascination for many Americans on this side of the Atlantic, as it is for me. But what she does so masterfully is she ties this to slavery that's going on and shows how it helped transform Britain's art and architecture. And I say, once I picked up the book, I could not put it down. So readers, listeners, go out there and pick up a copy today.